Hello, everybody. Mark O'Donnell here with Operations Excellence. Welcome to episode 9 of the Operations Excellence podcast. And we have two guests for you today. Our first guest, I'm very excited to have the conversation with, and welcome to the show, Dr. Mark Pietropaoli from Victory in Motion. Mark, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Mark. Appreciate it. Glad to be here.
Great to have you. Tell our listeners a little bit about Victory in Motion, and I don't know if you want to start with your background or start with Victory in Motion first, but
I'll just start with my background, I suppose. So my name is Mark Pietropaoli. I am the founder and CEO of Victory Sports Medicine and Orthopedics, also Victory in Motion, home of knee repair, not knee replacement. So how do we get from one to the other? I am a fellowship-trained sports medicine orthopedic surgeon. So I trained actually in Syracuse medical school and residency, orthopedic residency, mm-hmm. And college for that matter. So yes, if you cut me, I do bleed orange.
Excellent.
And it's tough right
me
now.
Me too. But
I'll see if we can beat Clemson. Anyway, so yes, I spent a lot of years here, 13 or 14 years here. And then I went and did a sports medicine fellowship with Dr. James Andrews, who's the greatest sports medicine doctor of all time. That was down in Birmingham, Alabama. So I came back, I joined a practice in Auburn, New York. I'm from Rochester originally. And after a couple of years, I decided to go on my own. So I formed Victory Sports Medicine and Orthopedics in Skinny Atlas, New York in 2001. And I was just, you know, kind of like any other surgeon. You want to do as much surgery as you can. And that was kind of the way we were trained during my residency. It was like surgery, 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 surgery. And I grew up using my hands. My dad put himself through law school at Syracuse and college working construction. So I learned how to use my hands. I learned how to use power tools. I learned how to saws, drills, all that stuff. And he taught me how to quality work, measure twice, cut once. Mm-hmm. So growing up in Rochester, we did have Buffalo Bills season tickets, and we used to go to the games. And my uncle, my dad's brother, is a doctor, the original Dr. Pietropaoli. And so I would see these guys run on the field when a player got hurt. And I was like, well, who are those guys? And my uncle said, well, one of them's the athletic trainer. But I go, who's the guy in the suit? That's the doctor. He's the sports medicine doctor. Right. He's the team doctor. And I was like, wow, that would be really cool. I'd love to do that someday. And he's like, well, you need to be an orthopedic surgeon to do that. So that's kind of how I got into orthopedic surgery.
Okay.
And we're trained to be surgeons and do surgery. And so when I did my fellowship with Dr. Andrews, I learned a few different things. Instead of just doing only surgery, I learned a little bit about more like how to take care of the patient before the surgery, how to take care of the patient after the surgery, how to prevent surgery. Mm. And that was surprising to me because all you heard about on ESPN was this guy went to Dr. Andrews. Oops, excuse me. This guy went to Dr. Andrews. I'm Italian. I talk with my hands.
I get it.
So this guy went to Dr. Andrews. That guy went to Dr. Andrews. And right. So I thought, you know, we're going to do a ton of surgery, which we did. But 80% of the people we saw usually didn't end up needing surgery because he had a really great physical therapist, the whole team. But Dr. Kevin Wilk, who's like the GOAT of physical therapists in the world, he would get about 80% of these people better. So I kind of learned.
Can I pause?
Yeah, absolutely.
That sounds like an exceptionally high percentage. Is that
yeah.
normal or is that way above the curve?
I mean, even as even in practice, depending on the type of practice you have, most patients don't usually need surgery. I know that sounds crazy coming from a surgeon. And now if you have a highly referred practice where there's a lot of steps that someone has to get to before they see you,
right.
Some surgeons will only see people who need, you know, quote unquote, supposedly need surgery, which everybody, you know, even that isn't
right.
really the case a lot of times.
Okay.
And so when I started my practice, I was doing knee replacements, big incisions. And as time went on, since 2001, I started doing smaller and smaller, more minimally invasive procedures. And growing up, I loved watching Star Trek. So Dr. Bones McCoy, he had this thing called a tricorder where you could look inside somebody and diagnose them without having to cut. And you could also treat them and cure them without having to cut into them or put needles into them or whatever. So I always thought in my head, even though I loved doing surgery, someday we're going to get to that point. Mm-hmm. And I always had that, I want to be on that cutting edge and be that type of a person. So, you know, even during my fellowship, Dr. Bradley, who's the Steelers team doctor, mm-hmm. he came and spoke to us and he talked to us about using a patient's blood, the growth factors in the blood, PRP, platelet-rich plasma, to help these athletes heal. And most of the crowd was surgeons. And they were like, oh, I'm not going to do that. That sounds stupid. You know, it's not surgery. But he was on the cutting edge. And Hines Ward, a couple years later, tore his MCL in the AFC Championship game. 2 weeks later, he was playing the Super Bowl because Dr. Bradley did the PRP injection, the biologic injection on him, and got him to heal.
Which, if he had the surgery, would not have happened.
No way. Right. Yeah. Or if he just got treated with even without that, it would have taken longer to heal.
To heal, right.
Absolutely.
Right.
So as time's gone on, my practice has evolved. I've done more and more, gotten more and more involved in repairing and not replacing. Mm-hmm. Even the first time I was in watching a surgery when I was a medical student, I asked the question, is there any way to repair a knee and not replace it or cure arthritis? And the resident screamed at me and said, no, there's no way to, you know, repair cartilage or grow back new cartilage. You can't repair a knee. You can only replace it. And so from that day on, I was like, I'm going to prove that guy wrong. And so
it is a challenge.
Yeah. Over time, we've gotten more and more minimally invasive, more and more biologic, using your own body's ability to heal itself. So we decided to change our name and our brand from Victory Sports Medicine and Orthopedics, which is a little more surgical, mm-hmm. to Victory in Motion. We kept the victory, but motion is medicine. It's more of a holistic approach.
Right.
If you still need a surgery, I can still do it, minimally invasive. But a lot of times we can get you to heal using your own cells, your own blood, your own growth factors, laser, non-invasive things.
That's awesome. And when we met a few weeks ago and talked, you went into some more detail. I wonder if you could share with our listeners a little bit more detail of some of the procedures and the approaches in a little bit more detail that you actually use when it comes to treating a knee or another joint to not have to go the surgical route.
Yeah, and so I think that brings up a good point there as well. You use the word procedure, but that's only one small part of what we do. We do a whole program.
Right.
So I was dabbling in, not necessarily dabbling, but I was performing some of these PRP shots occasionally or using bone marrow, which has stem cells and other cells that help the stem cells. People have heard of stem cells. Stem cells can turn into cartilage, bone, ligament, heart, lung, whatever. The way they also work is they tell other cells what to do, so they help other cells to heal. Mm-hmm. And so our bone marrow has a lot of stem cells in it, and so we use bone marrow. And I was doing those things, and I was doing some laser treatments. I had a torn calf muscle since I ran a marathon in 2012, and 6 years later, someone introduced me to laser, and that tear that had been bothering me on and off for all those years got better and healed and haven't had a problem since. So I started getting to all these other treatments, and I always dreamed about putting them all together into a program. And I was kind of afraid to do it. And some of these things aren't covered by insurance because you know how insurance is. If it works, they won't cover it. But COVID hits. And so I had a lot of patients who I was still performing knee replacements at that time. Mm-hmm. COVID hits. And a lot of those patients we couldn't do surgery on because the hospitals and the surgery centers shut down.
Right.
So they were all like, Doc, what can I do? You know, I've tried everything. Is there anything I can do? And I'm like, well, I don't know when the surgery centers are going to open back up, but we have all these regenerative techniques I've talked to you before. Let's try them as a program. So I put them all together. So it might be an injection of the PRP and the bone marrow cells, but also using laser, which is non-invasive, total body fitness. So, you know, a lot of people who have shoulder pain, their neck is an issue, or their upper back. A lot of people who have knee pain, their hip and their ankle are a problem, or even their back.
Right.
So we treat the whole body. We evaluate the whole body. And the same thing. For every pound of weight that you gain, you add 3 or 4 pounds of force across your knee. So if you're 10 pounds overweight, that's 30 or 40 extra pounds of weight going across that knee or that hip. So
every time
you take a step. And running, it could be even 10 times that amount of force. So what we got into is the diet and the nutrition and the weight loss and really more fat loss, losing inflammation. Because mm-hmm. if you gain muscle mass and you lose fat, you might gain weight, but you're going to be in better shape.
Right.
So we partner with a company that tests your genetics because a lot of people think, oh, I need to be on a high protein diet or low carb or carnivore or vegan or whatever. You don't know unless you really know. And the only way you know is to test somebody's genetics.
And that's so that gets to every individual's metabolism is a little bit different.
Yeah, everybody's different.
Right.
And so we test the genetics and get a report back, and then we can tailor your diet to your genetics and decrease the inflammation in your body so, A, you heal better, B, any programs or procedures we do on you work better, but also your blood pressure may go down. It'll help your heart. Diabetes. I mean, we have patients go off their medications. Their primary care doctors are like, wow, what happened? And it was just their diet and the right type of metabolic exercise. So it's a holistic approach, not just a shot or a procedure. But yes, we will do injections of, we'll take the blood, spin it down, get the platelets out. The platelets are those things that when you cut yourself, you form a scab and they stop you from bleeding to death. But they have growth factors, and those growth factors stimulate new blood vessels and cells to grow. So if we can concentrate those, the blood, get the platelets injected into an area that needs help healing, it can help. And the same thing, the bone marrow cells, it has the stem cells and other cells that help the stem cells. The cells do the work, so that's even more effective. It's a little more invasive. We have to harvest that from the pelvis, which is an area above your butt area. It's not your hip. People always say the hip or the back. It's an area underneath the skin. We can numb it up in the office. I had it done myself. It's not that big of a deal, but it is a little bit more invasive than just drawing blood, but it's nowhere near as invasive as surgery, because I've had five surgeries and I've had the bone marrow, and it's not even close.
Right, right. It's amazing stuff. And, you know, one of the interesting things I hear is it's a program, right, or a process. So it's all inclusive, and it's really a whole body treatment and approach to an individual's health, which is really holistic, but it's really customized too, right?
Sure is. Yep.
Talk some little bit more about that customization. I mean, you talked about, okay, you're looking at genetics for metabolism, but you know, you might have two people with the exact same symptoms, but the approach and the program might be very different.
1,000%. Exactly right. So the principles are the same, but we do customize every program, and we customize it based on what your goals are. Mm-hmm. So a lot of people will come to us and be like, oh, I want to do this. I want to do knee repair, not knee replacement, or I want to get my shoulder fixed, or I want to get my – and we're like, well, we got to figure out what's wrong first, because you might not need some of the things we do. There might be simpler things we can find for you, or you might need more. You might need surgery. There are people who, you know, if you have something loose floating around in your knee that's locking your knee up, no shots are going to make that go away. You're going to need surgery, which I can perform that too. But so it depends on what's wrong with you first. So first we want to figure that out, and that's called Clarity Day. So we'll get you in, and you know how this goes. Normally, if you go see your doctor, they might say, oh, take some medication and, you know, get back to me in you know, 30 days if it's not better. And then you call and you're like, oh, I'm not any better. Okay, we'll order an x-ray. Now you got to call to get the x-ray set up. You have to go somewhere else. You don't get a phone call back. You call the place. They're like, well, we can't give you the answer. Your primary care has to. So you call there. They act like, why are you calling? You say, well, I want to know my results. Well, I can't give them to you. The doctor has to. So you wait another couple weeks. Doctor calls you. You hear them typing on the computer. They're reading the report. They're not looking at the x-rays. Oh, you have arthritis. You're probably going to need a knee replacement. I'm going to send you to physical therapy first. So that takes another, 3 weeks to get scheduled.
Yep.
Maybe 6 weeks of that. So that's like 12 visits back and forth. If both your knees hurt and your shoulder hurts, guess what? You're out of luck. They can only treat one joint at a time because that's the way the insurance works. So you come back and they're like, okay, that didn't work. I'm going to send you to an orthopedic surgeon. So you go see the orthopedic surgeon. That takes a while to get in. They see you for like 5 minutes. Yep, you're going to need a knee replacement, but let's try a cortisone shot first, which that might help a little bit because cortisone does decrease swelling and inflammation, but we know it also damages your cartilage. So people who get cortisone shots, those studies have shown their arthritis gets worse compared to people who don't get cortisone shots. So why give someone something that's harmful?
Yeah, I had a cortisone shot in my shoulder. And what you just described is years ago when I had a torn rotator cuff issue and tear in the rotator cuff. I won't mention the doctor's name. He's retired now. Great guy. But he gave me a cortisone shot in my shoulder, and it was great for about 24 or 36 hours. I went out and played golf the next morning, and my brothers were complaining because it's like, well, you know, that's not fair. You've got, you know, something in your – I'm like, come on, this is not like performance-enhancing drugs here. But, you know, day after, total pain right back. So, and it was exactly what you described. Oh, try this, try this, try this. And then finally
– yeah, and I mean – one little caveat to even for a rotator cuff, if you inject somebody's shoulder with a cortisone shot, and maybe you do get better for 6 weeks or so, because that's about how long they effectively last. Some people longer, some people less, but let's say it helps for 6 weeks, but then you still need surgery within the year.
Right.
People who have had a cortisone shot, if they have surgery within that year, the cortisone negatively affects the ability of that to heal. So they have a lot lower chance of healing and a lot higher chance of it re-tearing. Really? So it's just not a good thing. And so, you know, but that's what the system does. You get a cortisone shot, you might get the gel shots. Finally, you know, they won't do an MRI. No, we're not doing an MRI. But the MRI might show these bone microfractures that cause the pain and arthritis. And those are curable. We can get those to heal. But a lot of doctors don't know that. So they'll just say, you need a knee replacement. And you might be like, well, I don't want a knee replacement. Or you just go with it, right? And then maybe you do great, maybe you don't. You know, right. 20 or 30% of people don't do well with a knee replacement. So you got it, you know, there's a chance it might not work.
Right.
And once it doesn't work, you got metal, plastic, and cement in you forever.
Right.
So it's always worth trying as much as you can beforehand, in my opinion. Yeah. And so, yeah, so that might take, who knows, 6 months, 3 months, 6 months, a year to them to finally get to the point where you kind of know what's going on. We'll do all that in one day. So, like, we'll get you in. We'll go through all your records. We'll spend an hour with you just right off the bat. Figure out what's wrong. Get your whole history. Talk to you. Sit. Not just 7 minutes, 10 minutes, like the average doctor visit in the U.S. Then we'll do a full physical exam on you, where a lot of, you'd be surprised how many people say, no one ever did that before. And I'd be like, what do you mean? No one ever did what? No one ever put their hands on me and actually examined me. So we do that. Then we'll have a fresh set of digital x-rays, usually standing, making sure we get x-rays of your kneecap, because people miss arthritis under the kneecap all the time. We'll do an ultrasound where we can look inside your knee live, so we can see the fluid. We can see if there's anything floating around. We can see if there's a cyst. We can look at your tendons and your muscles as they're working. Really cool. And then we'll also do an MRI. Yes, x-rays can show arthritis, and the MRI can as well, but the MRI shows the bone underneath the cartilage.
Right.
And if that has these soft spots or these stress or microfractures, that's something we can actually inject bone marrow cells into and get it to heal. So that's repairing your knee and avoiding a knee replacement. And once we do that, we'll get you your total body evaluated by our VFit total body fitness specialists. Then we'll all meet as a team. We'll talk. Then we'll go back in, and hopefully you have your spouse or your loved one or a mom or a dad or a sister or brother or friend in the room with you, because we always encourage that, because, you know, you learn, there's a lot of information that we get to you, and we'll tell you exactly what's going on. You'll know exactly. You'll look at your x-rays. You'll look at your MRI. The report will be in there. We'll have the radiologist already read it. We'll look at it with you. So we go through everything. Then at that point, we'll give you maybe three options. Well, we might say, we can't help you. You need whatever. That's rare. But if you need a referral somewhere, we'll get you there.
Right.
But as far as most people, we can help them. And we'll give you, like, let's say, a good, better, and best plan. Mm-hmm. And you get to choose what you think is best for you. And you can always say no. Whereas you go to a lot of doctor's offices, they just say you need surgery. And you kind of do it. But, like, if you don't want to do it, you don't have to. Most of this stuff isn't life-threatening. But most people, quality of life matters a lot.
Sure.
And maybe they're retired and they put all their money away and they can't travel, they can't play with the grandkids, they can't golf, they can't play pickleball. They're the slow one all the time, or maybe they might have to move out of their house they've lived in, you know, their whole life, because they can't go up and down the stairs all, you know, anymore.
Right.
That stuff's a home run. We can get people going up and down stairs. We can get people walking with their dog. We can get people traveling again. Those are all goals that we hear all the time. So to your point, whatever your goals are, and once we figure out exactly what's wrong, then we will give you a plan customized to you to give you the best chance of reaching your goals and your dreams.
Could you improve my golf swing?
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. Yeah, absolutely.
You're gonna help me generate more club head speed?
I can't guarantee that your score will get better, but it probably will.
I love it.
We definitely can do that. Absolutely.
That is...
we do it all the time.
Awesome. Yeah. So you talked about how the pandemic was really the catalyst.
It was.
Right, that really kind of changed, and it changed your business model dramatically. When you and I met and chatted at your offices a few weeks ago, you mentioned that now you're no longer insurance based. And so talk to the listeners and tell me a little bit about that transition business wise. And because I know that wasn't all easy, right? And it's still kind of a work in progress.
Yes.
Yeah.
There's a few factors to that. One, people might say, well, they don't participate with insurance anymore. That's terrible. Well, it's actually good because we can get all that stuff done in one day. Whereas if you participate with insurance, you can't do that. It's right. impossible.
Right.
They won't, you can't do it. So that's one of the biggest things. There's no limitations. We can decide what we think the best treatment is for you, and we don't have to worry about what the insurance says. Then you can decide for yourself if you want to do it or not. So right. in that way, there's no one's forcing you to do anything. I don't have to say, well, the insurance says this or the insurance says that. I just say, this is what I think is best. We've done this, you know, a gazillion times, and you decide. So in that regard, there's a lot more freedom. And I think it is a good thing. We can get things done much, much quicker and get people better much quicker. I mean, the average time for an MRI in the U.S., maybe not in this area because we're a little better than this, but like it's 9 to 16 weeks for someone to get an MRI ordered to getting their MRI and getting their results. That's 3 or 4 months. We can have you through a whole program. So speed right. and efficiency and actual results, we can get that done much quicker.
Which is kind of crazy because if it's 9 to 16 weeks, that whole time, if somebody's in pain, they're in pain.
They're in pain. Yeah. It's terrible. Then they might get on narcotics or things like that, right?
That's what killers.
Or yeah. they take anti-inflammatories that rip their stomach apart or make their blood pressure go up. So
right.
totally agree with you.
Yeah.
That's a problem. So the other thing is what we found was the more of the biologic stuff, helping your body heal itself that we did, the more amazed we were with it and the more amazed patients were with it. So we started doing more and more of it. And at one point I got to the point where like 70 or 80% of what I was doing was these type of things, which insurance doesn't cover. Now, don't ask me exactly why they don't cover it, but part of it might be it's your cells, it's your blood, it's your growth factors. How can an insurance company like regulate that or a drug company? They can't. So that may be why they don't cover it. I don't know for sure. Obviously, there's no big pharma that is making your cells and right. selling them to an insurance company, then selling them to me and me. You know, like there's none of that. So it's you healing yourself, and we're just helping you do that.
Right.
So when it got to 70 to 80% of what we were doing was that type of stuff, after 26 years of answering to the insurance companies and having no say, like I, a single physician, I have a lot of staff, but I've always been the only physician. I may have had a PA and a nurse practitioner, et cetera,
right.
but I have no bargaining power and I have no control over anything. So we just decided to say no to the insurance companies. Now, that doesn't mean that if you have an MRI with us or you have a regular visit or you have an x-ray or an ultrasound that we can't give you codes that you can submit to your insurance. Just like I go to my dentist or you go to other practitioners that don't take insurance, they'll give you the codes, you can submit it. Now, surprisingly, sometimes people get, you know, reimbursed quite a bit for that. Other times the insurance won't reimburse them at all. Sometimes they get less, sometimes it's very variable, but most people will get something back for those codes. But right. there are no codes for like PRP for joints, for instance, or for stem cells or for laser or even like a lot of diet and exercise stuff. There's no code for fitness.
Right.
So they won't pay for that. They won't pay for a genetic nutrition plan. And
but
so,
you can't be the only doctor in the United States doing this.
No, definitely not. There's a network of there's regenerative medicine doctors and then there's functional medicine doctors. The functional medicine doctors are doing more of the hormone therapy, the bioidentical hormone therapy.
Right.
We're not really doing that ourselves right now, but we probably will get more into that eventually because that is a very holistic approach as well.
Right.
But the regenerative medicine doctors, I mean, there's a fair amount of them in the United States and around the world.
Hmm.
And there are people hear about stem cells and they hear about donated stem cells and exosomes and all these different things. In the U.S., it's not legal to use somebody else's stem cells or exosomes, peptides,
right.
technically. So that's where people have to go overseas. Now, I do have a clinic that I'm associated with down in Roatan, which is an island in the Caribbean. I don't go there very often because most people don't need to. They just stay here in the United States and we fix them up. But there are a lot of quote-unquote stem cell clinics overseas. And they do charge a lot
right.
for
but to clarify,
just the
what
shot.
What you're doing primarily is using each individual's own cells.
Using your own cells,
own body,
your own blood.
To cure
themselves. Yeah, it doesn't even leave the room. So
the question that is begging to be asked is, and I know you can't predict the future and you don't speak for any insurance companies, but at some point, and this is what my brain is thinking, I got to believe a knee replacement or a hip replacement cost a lot more money than the program you're describing.
For sure.
So at some point, wouldn't some, even if it's a accountant, financial person at an insurance company, go, hey, why aren't we supporting this?
Well,
even as financial.
Because most of the insurance companies either own pharmacies or are owned by pharmacies.
Okay.
So keeping people on medication is very profitable. I'm not going to say that's the only, I'm not going to say that's what, you need to have insurance companies.
Right.
You need catastrophic care. You do. I have insurance, right? You do need it, but it could be revamped much better than it is. And part of that does have to do with, there's a lot of money to be made to keep people on medications instead of treating the root cause. And I hate to say it, that is part, and the system, the medical schools and all that, they are funded and also they have to answer to the insurance companies as well. And a lot of the pharmaceutical companies sponsor a lot of the things that the meds schools get and things like that. So if you can get that part out of it, then it would make a lot more sense to an accountant. But right now, a lot more sense to own a pharmacy and keep people on medications, a lot more. Insurance companies have trillions of dollars of profits, trillions. Big pharmaceutical companies, they have hundreds of billions. So they don't even, so even if insurance companies are not for profit, they're bringing in a lot of revenue. Let's put it that way. And it's just, that's the facts. I'm not saying they're all evil or anything like that. There's obviously a lot of good that comes from it,
sure.
But just like anything, kind of follow what is really, going on behind the scenes. I think that would be the reason why that hasn't happened yet. Plus, it is hard to regulate your own tissues in your own body. You're manufacturing it yourself. You're your own manufacturing company, and they can't really regulate that. So that's, I think, another issue with it. So it may never be covered to use your own cells. It might be more where eventually donated cells and things like that are purified better, regulated better, and maybe then you go into a freezer and you thaw out some stem cells and inject them into somebody. So that's probably going to come before approving using your own tissues. That would be my guess. I don't know that for sure, obviously.
Hmm. But what are the risks of using your own tissue?
Well, the risk of using your own tissue is almost nothing as far as using your own tissue. Obviously, if you're sticking a needle in, even when someone's getting an immunization, right, there's always a very slight risk of infection. So that's why they, so there's always a slight risk of infection. There's almost no risk of you having a reaction to yourself because it's your own tissue.
Right.
There are maybe some blood thinners that we put in so that it doesn't clot before we inject it back into you. Heparin, things like that some people can be allergic to, but that, again, that's pretty rare. And there's other alternatives if someone has an allergy to that type of thing. But there's very, 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 very low risk, extremely low. There's been studies done. It's like point blank, blank, blank percent risk of infection, point blank, blank risk of reaction to or allergic reaction, things like that. Whereas even like a knee replacement, it's 1 or 2% risk of an infection. But if there's a million knee replacements being done a year, that's 10 or 20,000 infections.
Big number.
And those are disasters. My dad, unfortunately, once you get a knee replacement, you're not out of the woods. Once you recover from the surgery, you still have metal and plastic in you, whether it's a hip or a knee or whatever joint. And so that's why a lot of times your dentist will have you take antibiotics. That's a little controversial, to prevent like bacteria from getting into your bloodstream and then going into the metal and the plastic and causing an infection. But if you're diabetic and you get an infected toenail and you have a knee replacement, you have a pretty high risk of getting an infection. You got to treat that aggressively and get rid of that infection before it gets into the knee or the hip. My dad, unfortunately, got one into his hip. They don't even know really where it came from. He needed multiple surgeries. They were never able to put the metal plastic back in there, so it had to heal open and just like a shark bite, slowly heal over 6 months. And then his leg was about 4 or 5 inches shorter. He was a big golfer, loved golfing, and he got back maybe one time. And then he also, he suffered a lot. And then I think all that stress, the next thing you know, he's got pancreatic cancer. So he's no longer with us.
Sorry to hear that.
No, I know. It's not benign. Even years down the road if you have metal, plastic, and cement in your body.
Right, which makes a lot of sense. I mean, you've got a foreign material in your body. So let's go back for a minute, if we could, and talk a little bit more about the transition in business model and what that's looked like for you and your staff and your business.
Yep. So as we looked at the insurances, once I decided I wanted to be more like, you know, Dr. McCoy and be more biologic, less invasive, and that was about 3 years ago, we looked at this is the old 80-20 rule, right? I mean, 80% of the insurances we took maybe brought in 20% of our revenue, whereas 20% of the insurance brought in 80% of our revenue. So we dumped the 80% of insurances that were just not good and or we were even losing money on, and had kept 20%, which happened to be Blue Cross Blue Shield, Medicare, and workers' comp. So we lived with that for a while as we honed what we were doing, but the goal was always to go insurance-free because we just knew they weren't going to cover these services, at least for the time being. Mm-hmm. And so January of this past year, we were completely insurance-free. So one advantage to that is you don't need nearly as many staff, so your overhead goes way down. A big disadvantage is if you're a company, and 3 years ago I had 32 employees, you do have to downsize. And that for me was the hardest thing I ever had to do in my life was, you know, I didn't fire people because they were great. I had to lay people off because I didn't need billing people anymore. I didn't need all the administrative stuff.
Right.
So that's an advantage to that type of, it's an advantage to overhead into your business, but it's not an advantage to those people that you had to let go, which was really difficult. So for me, that was the hardest part by far.
Sure.
And I probably waited too long. Most people say, don't wait. And I kept waiting. But, you know, if you know you have to do it, you should do it. I mean, that's one business piece of advice I would have. Listen to your advisors.
Yeah.
If your advisor tells you, you know, that this doesn't make sense, it's not going to change magically, you know. So I'm sure you would have advised me to do what I did a lot earlier. And so my advice to people is to listen to your advisors. You hired them for a reason.
They're, right.
You're someone's coach for a reason. And so if they hire you as a coach, they got to listen to you.
Well, and from our previous discussion, I really got the impression that you looked at these people almost like family. They were,
oh, yeah.
You're that kind of guy. And I appreciate that, you know, and I respect that. But at the end of the day, you know, you made a huge decision business-wise, set aside the medicine part for a second, to change your business model, right? And you said, right, I don't need these other functions because that's not part of my business model anymore.
Exactly.
In my brain, I'm kind of thinking about conversations I've had with people over the years about having family in the business. And I remember one individual, and I won't use any names, and this is a true story, you know, sitting in a private conversation, was describing some things, what happened, and, you know, this, and this happened. And I was like, okay. Let me ask you a question. If this person wasn't family, what would you have done? And he just kind of looked at me and that was the answer.
Yeah.
You know, and it is hard, right? I mean, I literally have gone through situations in the roles I've had in the professional world where we had to lay off, and I won't mention the local company, but I was a VP of operations, and we were in some serious financial problems. I had to lay off 22 managers. In one day.
Yeah. Oof.
Now, these are people, I had been there long enough. I knew them. I knew their spouses. I knew their kids. Yeah. And I didn't have to be part of those meetings, but I told the head of HR, no, I'm going to do every meeting with you personally. They deserve that. Even if they, you know, want to cry, want to tell me off, tell me to whatever, they deserve that. And so we started at 7:30 in the morning, didn't finish until after 4 o'clock in the afternoon. And it was the longest, worst day of my life. And
yeah, so, you'll never forget it.
Yeah.
Terrible day.
You know, it's not something you want to do because we're human, you know, and if we're any good at being leaders, then we do care about our people, you know? And so I don't think that's a negative per se. I mean, you know, if that wasn't hard to do, I would say that's a problem. You know, yeah. So you changed the business model. Now you've got a much leaner staff, and here you are today. What's it look like today, and where do you go from here?
Well, the staff that I have now, the one really, really, really nice, nice thing is they are like all in. Our values are trust, excellence, all in, and resiliency, and they are all of those things. So that's really awesome. And we just hired somebody, a doctor of physical therapy, and she came in, and she's in her second week, and the team is just doing such a great job of like training her. And they set aside 2 weeks. They didn't throw her to the wolves, because a lot of times when you're in a regular insurance practice, like I said, I there were times I saw 60 or 70 patients in a day. That's crazy.
That is crazy.
But you know, it was like maybe 20 to 40. So now we're seeing 2 to 4 a day. We're spending 4 or 5 hours with them.
Right.
And so you don't need as many staff, that's for sure. You do feel weird. You feel like this doesn't feel right. I need to be like, you know, I need to be going constantly. So right. That's really hard, that part of it. And then, you know, the staff, you know, you have to have a dedicated staff who believes in what your mission is,
yep.
Who believes in you, who believes in each other, to go through that. And the people that I have are like, every day they're just stepping up and doing amazing things. Now, the other thing is, when you participate in insurance, obviously, or you take call, like people come to you like automatically, they are referred to you. It's you have automatic referrals, I should say, leads, whatever you want to call them.
Right.
Without insurance, our still number one source of people coming to see us is previous people who saw us, or referrals from previous people who saw us, because they know, like, and trust us.
Right.
Or doctors who know us from before, they still refer people to us. But you don't have, for new people, it's a lot more difficult. So getting the word out, thank you for having me on, because I think this
My
helps.
Pleasure.
And I don't do a podcast yet, but I'm going to do one. But I do
Welcome to
long,
the family.
Yeah, I do long form videos on, you can check out our YouTube channel, Victory in Motion One, but also Facebook, Instagram, Victory in Motion One, Dr. Mark Petropoli, TikTok. So we're on all those things, but getting the word out is probably the hardest thing. That's definitely the hardest thing.
Well,
of
new,
non-insurance.
Right? Like, yeah. You didn't have to do that. Previously.
Not much. I mean, did we do a little marketing? Yeah, but it was just more like someone would come to you and say, hey, you want to sponsor this event, or you want to sponsor that,
sure.
You know, and of course you would, but this is different. This is more, it is more thoughtful and more planned out, because you do want people to hear, we want people to hear our message, because people only think there's two solutions, you know, get your knee replaced or suck it up until you come back to me and get your knee replaced. And
right.
We're saying, no, there's a third option. You can repair the knee. Many people can repair the knee and not have to replace it.
Which is interesting, because I'm at the stage of life where a number of my friends have had knee replacement, hip replacements. And it's another reason why I'm so fascinated by this, because I'm not so sure at some point in the not too distant future, you know, that might be something that I'm going to have to look at.
Well, that brings up a good point too, because I just was getting fitted for some new glasses.
Yeah.
And before I came over here, and the woman that was doing that, she asked me what I did, and I was telling her, oh, I wish I saw you before. You know, she had 3 surgeries before, and I'm like, well, you know, we can still help. It's harder, right? But even if someone's had a knee replacement or a hip replacement and they still have pain, there's plenty of things we can do to help them. So we can still help that type of a person. I don't directly see neck and back stuff, because that's a whole different specialized area, but we see tons of people who have neck and back pain, and or it's related to their other problems. Right. So sometimes we can treat that without needing to do injections or surgery or anything. But if we do see someone and we think their back or their neck is their main issue, we have good people that we can refer them to who can do either, you know, the regenerative stuff,
right.
Non-operative stuff, or if they need surgery, help with that. There's people who need, you know, joint replacements, and I'll still refer them to colleagues of mine who I know very well, who I know, like, and trust. So we'll help the person no matter what, get them to where they need to be.
That's awesome. You've got the one location in Skinny Alice. Do you foresee any point in the future expanding on that, or what's your vision?
Well, first of all, yes, our location is it's 791 West Genesee Street, Skinny Atlas. But if you're coming from Syracuse, you drive past Rosalie's. Everybody knows Rosalie's Restaurant. And it's just a little bit further west, which is in the Quickfill Red Apple Skinny Atlas Urgent Care Plaza there. The reason I'm mentioning that is because next Thursday we have an open house. You guys are all invited.
Got the paperwork.
Yes.
Thank you.
So we're having an open house Thursday,
I'm going to be in
September
California,
25th. So, yeah. Well, you can invite anybody you want. So, Thursday, September 25th, 3 to 6 p.m. And you can come in and see, and we're going to do demos. We're going to show the lasers. We're going to give away some weight loss evaluations. We're going to raffle off a handheld laser, a whole program. So you get the laser and you get a whole program. We're going to be going through mini versions of that Clarity Day, because obviously we're not going to have people there for 4 or 5 hours, but we're going to kind of go through everything, demos, and then one person's going to win a luxury spa day at Mirabeau, which is
nice,
our neighbor right down the hill from us. So yeah, it's going to be fun.
That's awesome. I told these guys before you came in today, you know, the passion that you have for what you do, and how it was just palpable, and I love it. I love the story, and there's a pretty good chance I may introduce you to my wife as a possible patient, because she's younger than me, but she suffers from arthritis. And being Vietnamese, when it gets cold and damp around here, which it does for, 5 months out of the year, she suffers. I just really think there's got to be, listening to you, I believe there's got to be a better way that she could get some relief
for sure,
and have a better quality of life.
Yeah, so. Definitely. Is she going to go to California too with you? Or?
Oh, yeah. Say. Of course, when we get to California, she's probably
going to... Oh, that'll be great. She's not going to want to leave.
No, she's going to have me looking at houses is probably what's going to happen. No, we have a wedding to go to, so staying with some friends.
That'll be fun.
Yeah, it is. I'm looking forward to it. But
where in California?
The wedding's in San Clemente. A friend of mine that we're staying with lives in Fullerton.
Nice.
Which is kind of it's not too far from Anaheim.
Awesome.
So, yeah, it's a beautiful area. I've been out there a number of times over the years between business and having a friend that's lived there for 30 plus years. So, yeah.
That'll be fun.
Yeah. She'll definitely be, hey, why don't we live here? So,
Well, we'll do a private launch party. You guys can come when you get back.
Cool. And you may get a new client out of that.
Sure.
All right. Well, Mark, again, Doc, thank you so much. Pleasure to have you on. Good to see you again.
Great show. Yeah, great job.
Good luck.
Thank you very much.
That is all for our first segment. We'll be back with our second guest in just a moment. All right. Welcome back to episode 9. This is our second guest for the episode. I'd like to welcome my good friend, Will Staton. Will, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much, Mark. I really appreciate you having me. Glad to be here.
So Will and I have known each other, I was thinking about this morning. I think it's going on 3 years.
Believe so. And yeah, fall of 22, probably.
Yeah.
I moved to the Syracuse area in the summer of 21. So yeah. I think, yeah.
And we met each other through a local Rotary group, which they gratefully to me talked you into being president. And I was able to dodge that bullet. But tell the audience a little bit about yourself and your background and.
Absolutely. Well, I appreciate that you're grateful, and I'm also glad that you dodged the bullet. it was a fun experience. I learned a lot. We have some great people, but there's things to manage there. So, having said that, so my background, as I said, I've been here in Syracuse for just over 4 years now. Originally from Mississippi, so born and raised there, left when I was 16 to do a few years at boarding school, and then have hopped around quite a bit in the interim, lived in a number of different places. Have worked in K-12 education for my entire career. So I, as a college student, I majored in religion and classics, ancient history, and I loved it. I decided what my major was going to be on the day that they forced me to pick it, because I was just enjoying studying random things, and it didn't occur to me till after the fact that those majors put you on a career path that is dying, which is to go into academia, or on a career path to nowhere. But I loved it. I do not regret studying those things. As I got a little bit older toward the end of college, I learned about Teach for America, the organization that sends young folks into underprivileged schools around the country, primarily in urban, but in some rural areas as well. And I committed to teaching with TFA in Memphis, Tennessee, which is about an hour and a half from where I grew up in North Mississippi.
So if I could pause you there, hit the pause button, keep that train of thought.
Please.
And hold that placeholder. But how did you get interested in teaching, and what drew you to that thought of, yeah, I want to teach in the inner city?
Great question. started a little bit by accident. My senior year, I had not as many classes to take, so I had more time and needed some spending money. So I had a number of on-campus jobs, I think three to be exact, but one of them was a student recruiter for Teach for America. I had been recommended for the position, and I interviewed. I did not know really anything about the org and did not have a, I think maybe had taken one class in education. But got the job, and through doing that work and recruiting students for Teach for America, learned a lot about the organization, its mission and values, and it caused me to reflect a lot, especially in my 2 years at boarding school. Hmm. I visited some schools. I went to college in St. Louis and visited some schools in the city that may as well have been on a different planet from where I went to boarding school. And so it was kind of that reflection that made me realize, yeah, this is a problem. The inequity is staggering.
So you recognized the value of the opportunity you had, and had now you're exposed to a whole different section of society that not even close to the same opportunity.
Correct.
And that,
yes.
That kind of flicked a switch for you?
It did, yeah. And admittedly, you know, I was fortunate enough to spend those 2 years at boarding school, right? That isn't necessarily, you know, the bar that we should be aspiring to or can reach. But the contrast was so, so stark. And even compared to where I went to public school in Mississippi, that we have to do better than that. I know we can. And frankly, I look at it, you know, both as a moral imperative, because this country has the resources to do better by people. But it's also a pragmatic imperative. Like, we're cheating ourselves out of people's talents, right? Mm-hmm. I have had students who could have been, I mean, anything from tradespeople to small business owners to professors, nurses, doctors, you name it, right? Mm-hmm. Who knows? And their road is more challenging. That's its own unfortunate truth. But we're not giving them the chance, and we're cheating ourselves. So, yeah, I think there's a real imperative to solve that problem, and that it's both moral and pragmatic.
Okay.
So,
cool. So back to your story and what brought you to where you're at today.
Sure. And I'll accelerate it a little bit, but hopped around quite a bit. After the 2 years teaching in Memphis, I remained in education but moved first to New York City, then to Washington, D.C. And when we found out that we were having our oldest daughter, who was born in November of 21, we moved up to Syracuse to be near my wife's family. So that was summer, July, I believe, of 21.
So your draw to upstate New York was your wife's family. She's from this area originally.
Correct.
Okay.
Yep. And we knew that we were living in D.C. At the time. Didn't have, you know, real connections to the city. Had both of us went to grad school there, so there wasn't a strong, you know, reason to stay. And moving here, you know, we considered a few different options, looked into different job opportunities and stuff. But Syracuse made the most sense, and glad to have made the move. It's a, you know, it's a great place.
What'd you first think when you saw the snow?
Oh boy! Well, so because I did 2 years of boarding school in New Hampshire,
okay, so it wasn't your first time.
Well, mildly prepared, but it, I will say this: when we first moved here, I had a little shovel because I had to shovel some when we lived in D.C. It was mild, and that first winter, which according to y'all was a mild winter, now that I've lived here for a few years, I can see that that was true. But when folks were first telling me that that was a mild one, I'm like, y'all are crazy.
Well, we are.
Well, fair enough. But I had my little shovel, and the first time it snowed, I went and shoveled the driveway. I was like, great, this is no problem. I got this. And then we had a real snow, and we got this nice long driveway. And I went out, and I shoveled a patch like maybe as big of about a third of this table. It's just like, yeah, I'm done with this. And after it froze and melted enough for me to get out, I went and bought a snowblower. And that is a fun little toy, but yeah. But I had seen it once in New Hampshire, where it was enough to keep me from going to class. It had snowed so much, and I got emails from my teachers like, why are you okay? Why didn't you come to class today? And had to write back and say, sorry, like, if it snows this much where I come from, people would die. I saw the snow and just assumed, like, y'all don't, like, no, man, you're in New Hampshire now. We do things in the snow.
I can appreciate that. You know this because we've known each other, but I lived in Mississippi for 2 years, and literally I was shocked for the couple of years I was down there. They actually had a warning or a forecast of an ice storm, which never actually occurred, but everything shut down for at least 24 hours, and you couldn't buy a bottle of water at Walmart or any place else, which I was kind of shocked because I'm like one of the only guys in the parking lot that happens to go to Walmart during this emergency, which never happened, by the way. I'm like, well, it's raining out. What's the problem? Now, I'm a northerner. I've seen a foot and a half. I've seen 4 feet of snow fall in 24 hours. Like, this is nothing.
Yep.
But yeah, I get it. I get it. It's not what you're used to.
I very well remember that you were in Mississippi, Hattiesburg. Remind me what years you were there, because I do remember as a child we had an ice storm north in Oxford, and it shut down the place for 2 weeks.
I believe it. Yeah, I was there from 98 to 2000, essentially. So it was like actually ended up being two and a half years.
Okay. Yeah. I want to say it was a little bit before. I can't remember. I know as a kid, but we had to go. My mom she was dean of the law school at the time, and we actually had to go and sleep at the law school because everything had lost power, and you know, university had a generator, so we slept in her office.
I was lucky enough to get out before Katrina. I think Katrina was 2003.
Three.
I still own the home I had bought down there and actually rented it out for about a year, 18 months. That was a whole nother story we don't have the time to go into, but yeah, I had sold it. And then about a year later or so, after I'd sold that house, which I was so glad, I'm still wondering, there was a massive oak tree in the backyard that you could hear creak sometimes during the night, you know, when the wind was blowing. Like, if that came down on that house was trash. But
yeah, it's, I mean, Hattiesburg is far enough north that maybe, but it's still close enough to the...
It was only about 60 miles from the Gulf.
Oh, okay. Well, it's actually, I thought it was a little bit further north.
So 60 miles due south was the Gulf, so, But anyways, back to your story. We digress.
And I don't even know, I forget where I was. But yeah, have been in the Syracuse area for 4 years now. Working as a independent self-employed consultant, primarily in the education and nonprofit space. My last job before we moved from D.C. Needed to stay D.C.-based. I had to be out about from time to time, so it couldn't go fully remote. And then our daughter was born pretty shortly after we moved, so I was fortunate enough to have some time to take and be a dad and spend with her. But have been working, in the consulting space with schools and nonprofits since then, looking for opportunities to potentially expand beyond that. But even more importantly, more opportunities to get involved here in Syracuse. Most of the folks I work with currently, clients are in other places, New York City, D.C., Boston, et cetera. But again, I've lived in quite a few different places over the course of my life, and until I moved to Syracuse, the mindset moving to those places was always it was short term and temporary. I'm going to be here for 2 years of boarding school, or 4 years of college, or 2 years of Teach for America, whatever it is. And of course, crazier things have happened than us moving out of Syracuse. But we moved here to raise a family. It's a long term outlook, and so hope to be, expect to be, want to be here for the long term. And want to continue to find and look for ways to get plugged in, connected, and hopefully play my small part in, improving the city, pushing things forward. It seems like there's a lot of great stuff going on. I'd like to be part of that effort. And that's what led me to join Rotary, which is how we met initially. So,
And since you've relocated to Syracuse, you now have child number two. Your family has grown.
Yes, we do. Baby girl number two, and so both November birthdays. So in November, I will turn 40. Our oldest daughter, Sophie, will turn 4, and our youngest daughter, Chloe, will turn 1. And then I'm pretty sure the dog's in November, too. I think she's going to turn
9.
And of course, the dog will probably somehow take precedent among all those people. She somehow is still the queen of the house.
As long as she thinks so.
And I'm the court jester. That's the totem pole. Queen, empress, princess.
So wait
princess.
A minute. You're the only male in the household?
Yes.
Oh, boy. God bless you, my son. Wait till those girls of yours get to be teenagers and you're fighting for time in the bathroom. Good luck.
I can only imagine. We're forced them to share one and then, see how that goes. Right. So.
Tell our audience a little bit about your consulting and what you're actually doing with your clients now and how you're looking to expand on that.
Sure. There's a few different things that I focus on, but the one that I guess I'm most passionate about is organizational culture. It has been my experience having worked at number of places, all schools, but all sorts of different types of schools, and with students of all ages, is that really, you know, at the end of the day, people make the world turn. And as much as, you know, we can do all these crazy and great things with technology, if you don't have buy-in from people and from human beings, you're not as effective, and you may be destined for failure. I think I've learned and seen that lesson play out in all sorts of ways. Mm-hmm. And I have seen schools that I think could have done better underachieve because of poor culture. And I've seen schools that probably should have been struggling more overachieve because of really positive culture. Mm-hmm. And I think that's applicable to, you know, you name it, a for-profit business, a sports team, you know, it doesn't really matter, right? A healthy culture breeds whatever type of positive results you want, whether that's, you know, financial success or winning basketball games. And so it's an easier said than done task, certainly. Anytime you get a group of people together in any setting, it has the chance to become kind of small P political, right? Like, people will butt heads over things. There will be differences in communication styles, opinions, sure, et cetera. But that's all normal, and that's okay, right? How we respond to and how we manage some of those things is what matters. And we got to be intentional about that.
And what you just said, those two sentences, that is culture. Right. That kind of is the culture. It's how we respond to and manage those things. And then the kind of the bar we set and the expectation we set.
Yeah.
Right.
I think that's a great, simple definition for sure.
Yeah. So how, and I'm very fascinated about this, and you and I have had multiple conversations, because what I do in mostly the business world, although I do some work with not-for-profits and happy to do so. But primarily in a business world is still, I do work with companies on their culture, and that tends to be a pretty common theme. What kind of tools, how do you go into, say, a school and they're interested in your services, and how do you assess the situation, and then how do you develop a plan of attack, and then how do you implement that?
Sure. So I think, you know, the assessment piece, right? And a lot of times folks have done some of that work themselves before they contact you. I'm sure you've experienced that. But certainly, I mean, a lot of times if you're able to physically be in the space, you can almost feel or sense it, right? Yeah. The way people, you know, just like you would say for an individual, does that person kind of look like maybe they are depressed or happy, right? You can sense that in a workplace with a lot of people. Even more so because, you know, we play off each other's emotions even when it's subconscious and unintentional. So a lot of times it's there to see. Definitely try and go about getting at some of the root causes of that via qualitative data, right? Surveys and whatever evidence you can gather. Mm-hmm. Interviews sometimes with employees when you're able to have that, to hone in on what the problem or problems could be. I will say in my experience, a lot of times, not always, but it has come down to communication. I would say if there's one thing that seems to me to be the underlying crack in the foundation, that a lot of places have, it would be how they communicate with whom, to whom, et cetera. But, you know, regardless, once you've kind of done that diagnostic work, you can get a little bit more into things. As it comes then to addressing the problem, again, it'll vary a little bit. But one of the things that I have found most commonly, and one of the things I really stress, is making sure that you are setting up clear reporting structures, that people have an understanding of who they should be talking to about what and why, where to go with complaints and frustrations. And again, it's normal. I used to tell people when I was managing, like, be upset about that. I get it. That frustrated me too. Don't go put that toxicity and that negativity into the atmosphere. I'm your manager. Come to me. Right. Your frustrations are valid, but we have to manage and handle that in the appropriate way.
Right.
We're actually not going to fix the problem if our response to it is by griping about it to everyone else.
Correct.
That's probably counterintuitive. So again, making sure folks know who to go to, when to go to, and how to approach them. And also make sure that those people are approachable and know, you know, what they should be handling. It's certainly a two-way street about how that works. And then monitoring that, you know, making sure that it's being adhered to, and making sure that on top of that, you're creating a place where people do have understanding and empathy. Mm-hmm. We have a lot of pendulum swings, I think, in society in all sorts of ways. But one of them where I think we need to land kind of in the happy middle ground when it comes to the professional experience is, you know, traditionally, a lot of times there's this idea that you come to work and you turn off the emotional light switch, which is
is nonsense.
Right. Exactly. Right. My father is, you know, fighting for his life, and I'm supposed to not care about that for 8 hours in the middle of a Wednesday. Not a real thing. You know, other extreme of that pendulum is that the workplace becomes the therapist office, and that's not great either. No. Right. We want to have a middle ground. Again, easier said than done. And it requires real effort, you know, especially from leadership. But how do we, you know, recognize the humanity in people? How do we really build a place where we do understand, we do empathize, but we simultaneously have high expectations? Mm-hmm. And those aren't mutually exclusive, no. Right? You can do both, but again, it's much easier said than done to be like, yeah, I get it. This sucks. Will's dad is fighting for his life.
Right.
There are certain things still. How do we do it?
But you just said doing it well is hard.
Right.
Right. It's not easy, but the results, right, are worth the effort. So you said a lot that I'd like to kind of unpack a little bit. And I agree with everything you said. And it's interesting, you know, your approach is very similar, right, to what I do. And you said something interesting, and you kind of touched on this, that another way to look at culture. Culture is what it feels like to interact with an organization, mm-hmm. whether it's internally or externally, mm-hmm. right? So if you ask somebody about the culture, you're going to get words that describe feelings, mm-hmm. what it feels like, right? And so that's a great descriptor, mm-hmm. right? What's it feel like to work here,
yeah.
right? That's really the culture. What's it feel like as a customer to do business with this entity, mm-hmm. right? Or as a student to be a student
yeah.
in this organization, et cetera, et cetera. So I think that's a great point. And I love the way you described the diagnostics, right? Like I have a tool that we call Dialogue. It's a great scientific-based tool, right? And it is a blind survey where basically the entire employee population goes online and takes a survey. Nobody knows who's answered what, mm-hmm. right? So it's totally blind. It collates that information. But then on top of that, me as the facilitator, the consultant, would pick somewhere between 10 to 15% of the population, not the people that run the company, right. me.
Yeah.
So they can't stack the deck, mm-hmm. right? I pick randomly, and I interview.
Yep.
people. So that adds context to the answers. Mm-hmm. And then it comes up with this incredible report, which is based on seven areas. And I don't want to go way down the rabbit hole, but it's seven areas that really drive excellence in execution in an organization.
Yep.
And that's agreed on by multiple different entities. So it's very scientific based. Mm-hmm. And this result, here it is. And what it shows, another thing you talked about is communication. Right, is a big part of culture, because what this tool will show you is where are the disconnects.
Right.
Because one of my great little tricks I like to do when I get, you know, first time coming into an organization, now you hired me to do X, I like to meet different people from different levels and, mm-hmm. and have the CEO or the owner tell me, well, what do you think the culture is here? Describe the culture to yeah. me. Then ask the rest of the leadership team, mm-hmm. then ask the frontline managers, then all the way down to the frontline people. And if I've got four or five wildly different answers, that tells me a whole lot.
Mm-hmm.
And most of it not good,
yeah.
right? But that could be the core of here's a huge disconnect.
Right.
We don't even see things the same way.
Mm-hmm.
How can we go execute?
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
So that's a big thing. And yeah, the other piece you talked about, the implementation, right? Yeah. It's about helping people understand that you're right. And this is a big thing, especially I think in my generation, we were almost kind of, I don't know if it was taught or ingrained in us that leave your emotions at the mm-hmm. door.
Right.
Yeah. That's not humanly possible.
Right. Yeah.
right? Sorry. But that, you right. know, like you just described, if I've got a parent who is dying, there's no way that's not on my mind.
Right.
24/7.
Sure.
Right? Or if I'm dealing with a sick spouse or a child who's yeah. having struggles or whatever, fill in the
all
blank.
Sorts, yeah.
We're human,
mm-hmm.
right? We cannot compartmentalize that like that, right? Yeah. And you also made a great point that, yeah, we don't want the workplace to become, you know, the therapy session. I used to joke sometimes. I felt like my office, I didn't know if I should put on a Roman collar, you know, the priest collar, sure, yeah, right, for those of you non-Catholics out there, or put a shingle outside my door like the Peanuts, you know, like the doctor is in, five cents, you know, because part of that was I was grateful that I had the kind of relationship with my teams over the years. Most of them, I won't say all of them, but most of them, where they were comfortable,
right,
that they would tell me these things. But sometimes they'd leave my office, and I'd think, yeah, I don't know if I really wanted to know that.
Right.
But better me than to carry it around.
Right? Exactly.
So having a safe space, like you described, with their leader, their manager, where they can come. And sometimes if it is just a vent, right, but you have to have the kind of environment that promotes that.
Right.
And so much goes into that culture besides communication. Do you have the kind of culture that, you know, people want to stay there and would recommend friends to come work there with them, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that's a huge tell.
Absolutely.
Right? And what makes it a place that they want to work at, right? That they are respected, that we don't make it personal when we have disagreements, right? Because you said it, we're going to disagree.
Right.
I mean, if you have a lot of smart people around the table and you're talking about how to solve a problem, it's very likely going to get heated because people hold, you know, they're coming from a different angle. But as the leader, you want to be able to hear that all and then be willing to come to a decision.
Right.
You know, and sometimes, you know, I used to tell my people, look, when that door's closed and we can put it out on the table and hash it out, don't make it personal.
Yep.
We can vehemently disagree, right? But try to walk in the other person's shoes. Try to have some empathy. Understand where they're coming from. All right? But at the end of the day, when we make a decision, we walk out that door. We have to walk arm in arm, right? And I understood that in organizations I work for. I didn't always agree with the, you know, whatever the CEO or the president of the company or the owner decided at the end of the day. But they were in that role, and it was their job to make that final decision. So I have a... You know, I was grateful I had the opportunity to have my input heard and respected. And sometimes it got integrated into the decision and sometimes it didn't.
Sure.
Right? That's, you know, that's just the way the world works. And to think that you're always going to get your way, well, you know, that's that to me, that kind of shows a very low level of EQ. You know, and that's a whole nother discussion. But, you know, the other thing I like to work at with organizations is I mentioned EQ for a reason. It was kind of a segue for myself, I guess. A lot of times I find when there's real deep-seated cultural issues in an organization, it's because you don't have people in leadership roles across the company at all levels that have strong EQs.
Right.
And it's really about understanding my own emotions and having control over them so I don't overreact, that I don't snap just because I'm having a bad day, or I don't have time for you, right? That those are things as a leader that you have to understand you are a servant,
right?
That's really what you're there for. And the other piece of it is empathy. And you know, that's not a political word. That's a real thing,
right?
That, you know, empathy is not that it's not sympathy. I don't feel sorry for you.
Right.
It doesn't mean that I agree with you.
Right.
Empathy is just making the effort to understand what somebody else feels and why they feel that way. That's all it is. And by the way, if you are not empathetic at some level, you are not capable of forming deep human relationships.
Right. Yeah.
That's just the reality. That's not Marx's theory. That's the truth.
No, that, yeah. I mean, I one of the things I love reading about is animal intelligence. All sorts of creatures are intelligent in all sorts of ways that we don't necessarily understand. Mm-hmm. But, you know, empathy is a measured, I mean, you can measure the EQ of certain animals, right?
Yeah.
And so, yeah, to imagine that that's not a real thing is imagining, you know, elephants, chimpanzees, you name it.
Dogs.
Yeah, there you go. Cats. People joke about their cats wanting to kill them, and maybe they do. But even that is a form of empathy, if you think about it, right? A lot of really intense violent crime is committed by someone who has a close personal connection to you, even if it's negative. But to have that much whatever it is to drive you to a crime is actually, there's a degree of empathy there. There's a strong feeling. It's not how we think of it, because we always think of empathy as like, oh, well, I understand and relate to you. But if you've got a strong enough relationship with someone that can drive you to do that kind of thing, it necessarily even means. So this is
That goes you know, beyond empathy into some mental.
Well, sure. Yeah. It requires
illness issues, probably.
Yeah, it's not a result of empathy, but you can't build the relationship that leads you to that without a degree of empathy.
Right, because it's based on understanding.
Exactly.
And and an emotional connection.
Exactly.
Right? That I respect you. I'm going to make the effort to understand you.
Right.
And because of that, we're able to build a very deep trust-based relationship.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
And to me, the reason I bring it up is that is the core of a good, healthy culture in an organization. Because if you have that amongst all levels of an organization, it will be the kind of place that people want to work and that they're happy to, hey, I'm going to recommend my cousin because they just graduated college and they're really smart and I think they'd love to work here. And, you know, then you're going to get the best people and create that kind of organization.
I think one thing you said that in my mind is a really important part of that, you know, a lot of times you'd leave those leadership meetings and sometimes you thought that your input was considered and part of the decision and sometimes maybe it wasn't, but you had a chance to give your input.
Right.
And I think that that matters a ton. And I think a lot of organizations, maybe they don't realize it or maybe they just don't have good channels and methods in place to let people share opinions and feedback. But it's definitely been my experience, and I think most mature adults understand, like, yeah, you don't get your way all the time. That's just not how it works. My problem isn't that I disagreed with this decision. Mm-hmm. It's that no one ever asked me about it. Like, I at least wanted some input, and I think smart and mature people understand that and will be okay with decisions that they might disagree with as long as they feel like, you know what, this was a reasoned decision and I can believe that because I put in my 2 cents and I knew it was considered, even if that's not what we got to. But when you don't allow people that opportunity, you've kind of poisoned the ecosystem immediately.
Sure, absolutely. You know, it's being, you know, I always looked at it this way, you know, whether I had project managers, engineers, production people, planning people, procurement people, installation people, yada, 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 whatever their functions were. In their specialty, they know a lot more than me technically, right? So everybody around that table, when we laid an issue out on the table and talked about it, has a different perspective. So if I'm looking at that right, I'm able to do much closer to a 360 analysis and really see things from a different perspective. And hopefully, collectively, we're going to come to a better resolution than any of us would individually, right? And that's the whole point of that. But, you know, there's obviously pitfalls. You don't want to fall into groupthink and things like that. But, yeah, absolutely. It's giving people a voice and hearing them. And then, again, making sure that, you know, we respect each other, even if it's something, you know, if I say it's, you know, red and Joe says it's green and we vehemently believe where we're coming from, we can agree to disagree.
Right,
understanding that at the end of the day, we're all trying to do what's best for the organization, right? That's where we're trying to go. I love the way you described it. I think that's awesome. So where do you go from here? And I know it's a bit of a loaded question, but you know, where do you see? I know some of the things you've also done is you're a writer. You've been published, which I'm jealous of. you and I have talked about that over lunch more than once.
Thank you.
Although I've had articles published, but I've never had a book published.
So, I mean,
I'm not there yet.
I don't know. A lot of the stuff I write is more like short stories and poems. I used to do more kind of nonfiction essays, which were fun, but and were a good way for me to process my own thoughts on all sorts of issues. So I do still do that sometimes, but yeah, I don't know. I find writing to be, I call it a hobby, right? Everybody has their hobbies, but for me, something of a healthy outlet. I don't know. I enjoy it. I do produce a lot of content. I am not good at putting it out into the world. You know, whether that means submitting it to like agents or publications or whatever it might be. I enjoy that side of it less, but, I mean, I think everybody should have a hobby, right? It's not for me to say what that hobby is, but a healthy outlet for something that you enjoy is healthy. And writing definitely is one of the things that scratches that itch for me. So it also, it dovetails nicely, at least for me, with my interest in and love of history. Mm-hmm. So a lot of the stuff I write, the fiction kind of is, if not necessarily historical fiction, it's kind of rooted in that. And that gives me a fun way to, you know, even learn more about something that I'm interested in. Maybe I want to write a little short story about, actually, I did this recently. I wrote a little short story about Vlad the Impaler. And I knew enough going into writing that short story that I could write a decent amount of it, but it was a great opportunity for me to learn some more too and go do some research. So it's fun to have a hobby that also does that for you, I guess.
Which I find fascinating, and you had told me this before, that a mild-mannered, highly intelligent young guy like you is writing a short story based on Vlad the Impaler, who, if people don't know, was the, I believe, one of the original kind of historical bases for the Dracula story.
Yeah, correct. And in fact, his name was Vlad Dracula. Dracula meaning son of the dragon. So his dad, his father, was Vlad Dracul. So you just throw an A on that and you get Vlad, you know, child of son of the dragon. So, right. And yeah, you know, he was not a good guy. There's not a lot of good things to say about him.
Understood. I know enough about the historical context to be dangerous. So
well, the interesting thing about it is that, you know, and this is kind of the little thing that I wrote, was in the first person as his perspective, saying like, you know, he's not saying I'm a good guy, but he's saying like, you know, here I am, the one who's the namesake for this monster. When really, like, in the grand scheme of history's awful misdeeds, like, I'm not actually that high on the list.
Like, I'm not even in the top 10.
Yeah, right? Like, in terms of just, but, you know, and again, it's, there's no defending the things that he did. So it's not about that. It was just, it's a fun thing for me. But there is some truth to that, that, like, in the grand scheme of all the bad people who have existed, we named a fearsome monster after someone who's fairly low on the list of, like, you know, so.
Right.
But again, it's more than anything, that's a fun little activity for me, and a good way to learn. So
that's a really interesting mental exercise, though, right? Because you're allowing your creativity some free space, right? But you're also scratching that itch for the historical kind of factual stuff. So that's pretty cool. Thank you.
Well, let me, if it's okay, a quick minute to plug the history thing, because
absolutely.
Again, I was a religion and classics major, ancient history, and consider myself a huge history nerd still. Collect toy soldiers, read nonfiction for fun, all that jazz. And it's one of those things, you know, like a lot of subjects that would fall in kind of the humanities that in some ways are easy, or they're easily dismissed, not always legitimately so, but some of that makes a little sense, right? I even said myself earlier, like, what, I'm on the career path to doing what with these things, right? But that's the stereotype and the trope, and I think it's actually important to push back on it a little bit, because I look at history as being a map, a roadmap. And if you compare that to, you know, just looking at where we are now, you don't figure out where you want to go if you don't know where you've started from, right? There are multiple different routes to a destination, and if you don't know where you began, you're not sure to get there. Now, some people might counter that by saying, well, like, well, we're right here in time, and the future is there. So, I think that falls flat, right? How did we get right here in time? What hurdles and pitfalls did we accidentally create that now we're on that road ahead of us? If we don't understand where we're coming from, our efforts to get to a better place in the future are going to be less successful. And so I do think it's important. We don't all need to go down the rabbit holes that I do. We don't all need to enjoy writing, you know, short stories about Vlad the Impaler. But I do think that, you know, prioritizing these subjects in education, prioritizing national conversations, local conversations around this, it is important, and it does matter, because we will make more informed choices about the future if we have a better understanding of the past.
Oh, I couldn't agree more with you. And I you know, I'm a guy that loves history. I read a lot of biographies. I've read quite a bit of historical fiction, and I'm kind of a geek, you know, when the, you know, it's not anymore, but you hit the History Channel, right? Used to be, one of
used to
my
be.
Favorite, right? Not anymore, but, you know, now you can go YouTube stuff and you know, find short documentaries, but I couldn't agree more, and I think that there is a loss, you know, not at all, but in some in the younger generation weren't exposed in education and don't understand even, of course, you know, I'm 62 years old. You know, I've lived a lot longer in the 20th century than most, you know, people have. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when I was born, right, nobody had set foot on the moon yet.
Right, right.
You know, there were no cell phones. Yeah. You know, my father was a World War II vet.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I could go on, but to understand the history, even what they would consider modern history,
right?
The where, how, why, here's how we got here, and here's why we're here, right? That just lends context,
right?
Which is important because guess what happens in our world today? So much gets taken out of context, and then people don't understand the context because they're presented with information with no context.
Exactly.
And so if when it's presented in a void, people make up the context.
Exactly. And you make up the context to fit your beliefs instead of understanding the context and having your beliefs perhaps challenged.
Yeah. And in a business, you know, setting, I think it's really, you could use that same analogy, right? Understanding where we're at today in an organization and how we got here, right? And that's just taking the blinders off, taking the rose-colored glasses off, that when we do the analysis and present, it's like, look, this is not a judgment.
Mm-hmm.
This is just a clear-eyed, data-based look at what's going on today. Mm-hmm. Because as you said, I love that geometric analogy, right? I'm a math geek, right? So I always talk about geometry says I need 2 points in space to define a straight line.
Mm-hmm.
So if I know this point out here, which is where I want to go, and I can define that, right, with my aspirations, my dreams, my goals, all that good stuff, that's great. That's an important piece of work. But I can't draw the line to get there if I don't clearly – truly objectively understand where I am today.
Right.
And you know, the analogy I use in leadership or self-development is, right, we do a lot of focus on introspection, right? We're looking at all aspects of a person's life. We ask them to basically do that self-evaluation of all aspects of their life wheel, right? Which is not just when people think about their goals, they think about what? Career and financial primarily. But, you know, what about family?
Mm-hmm.
What about mental?
Yeah.
What about physical?
Yeah.
Right? What about social?
Mm-hmm.
Right? What about ethics and belief? Right? If any one of those is suffering in your life, you're probably an unhappy camper.
Yeah.
Right? So I could be the CEO and have 2 Ferraris in the driveway and have a multi-million-dollar home and be miserable.
Yeah.
Is that the kind of life you want, right? But to get from here to here, you have to clearly and be willing to objectively understand where you are. So yeah, I use that analogy, and I think it fits so well with what you're talking about with understanding history and the importance of it. Will, I believe we're out of time. I do want to say to you, my friend, it is a pleasure. I'd have you on anytime. We'll have you again.
Thank you,
sometime
sir.
In the not too distant future. And you know, besides our connection for the fact that you lived in, you were born and raised in Mississippi,
there you go,
spent some time there and still have some friends there. You know, I love what you're doing and keep up the good work, my friend.
Thank you, sir. I really appreciate you having me on. And, you know, I am actually going to be heading back to Mississippi soon for a football game. Hadn't been in a little bit, so I'm excited about that. But it makes me realize, you know, we have to find an excuse to go together sometime.
That'd be a
for some football.
I have not been back to Mississippi since probably 2002. I moved back up here in 2000. I think I went back in 2002 to visit some friends before Katrina.
Okay.
I haven't been back post-Katrina.
Gotcha.
So I would actually love to go see Hattiesburg.
There you go,
where I lived and my old stomping grounds, because I heard it's changed a lot. So
I'm sure it has. There's been some growth in the state. So
cool.
Awesome. Thanks again, Mark. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, my friend. That's it for episode 9.